Today's Issues continues on AFR with your host, Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association.
Hey, welcome back to Today's Issues. That's the name of this show on the American Family Radio Network. Dr. Ray Pritchard is in Kansas City, having moved from Dallas, and Ray joins us now as co-host of the program. And Walker Wildman is in studio with me in Tupelo, and so is Steve Jordahl. And I'm Tim Wildman, and Steve is with our One News Now team and American Family Radio News as well. Steve, I was looking up, I said some politicians in Washington are, quote, weasels, end quote. And I've heard that expression all my life. I thought it meant I was sneaky and slippery. Is that what?
I think that's what it. That's
is that what a weasel is. That what a weasel is.
The animal weasel burrows and slinks around, can fit into very tight spaces. It's a very flexible animal. So I think that's where it.
How would you do? You ever had any contact with a weasel?
I've had a contact with its cousin, the ferret. Ferrets. They used to have pet ferrets in Colorado. They sell them as pets. And a friend of mine had one, and this thing would come up to you, and it was a little flighty. In other words, it would come up, it would want to be petted, and then it would run away, and sometimes it would nibble at food.
Do you
had
walk your weasel?
I don't know about weasels. I know people walk their ferrets a little bit sometimes.
Walk their ferret.
Well, it's a small animal, so if you have a house that's, you know, it can run around.
I mean, do you
get
put it
exercise
on a leash?
No, I don't think so. You could. I mean,
right?
It would look a little odd.
Any, you have any life experiences with weasels or ferrets?
Very, very little. I've been around ferrets a little bit, and it's hard to grab them, you know? It's like Steve said, they'll come right up to you. You'll reach out your hand, and they'll dart away.
Can they bite you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, why would you reach out your hand?
You know, because they're kind of cute, right, Steve?
You
kind of look at them, and you when they come up to you, you think they're friendly. It's not necessarily so.
That's the reputation as, what do you call it, sort of sneaky.
Sneaky. Yeah. The family that I knew that had them had a teenage girl, and it's just like these kind of faces that you can't, you know, the, oh, they're so cute kind of thing.
Right.
So that's why they.
Oh, I'm sitting here looking at images of weasels. There's Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding, people.
Just a joke.
Just a joke. All right. That's okay.
I've called them not so nicer things on my radio show on the weekend. I don't use profanity.
That's good, Walker.
Yeah.
On Christian radio. Nice.
Dishonest, yes. Disingenuous.
Yes. I just said it, but Mitch McConnell, I will give Mitch McConnell, I get very frustrated with him a lot of times. I will give him credit for one big thing. It's about the only thing. He did block President Obama from appointing a far lefty to the Supreme Court when Antonin Scalia died. Remember that?
Yes.
And now he did it. He was right. Mitch McConnell was to do what he did because we were in an election year. And that's been the tip. That's been traditional over the course of our country's history, is not to appoint Supreme Court justices vacancies during an election year. Let the presidential election year, I'm talking about, let the election take place. Let the people speak. Let that be one of their considerations. And that's what Mitch McConnell did. But, you know, he could have, I guess, let President Obama appoint somebody, and that could have been very, very damaging. So, to Mitch McConnell's credit, he did block that from happening, and thus we got Neil Gorsuch. Now, we're going to have a moment of silence now, because that's what other positive things I have to say about Mitch McConnell. There we go. Okay.
All right.
Moving on to the what's going on, Steve, in the world of ours.
French President Macron is visiting in Washington, and he gave a speech to a joint session of Congress this morning. It was full of the usual platitudes about the French-American relationship. It was full of his calls for a green planet and for the U.S. to stay in the Paris Accords for
about
the
a
climate
new Statue
change.
Of Liberty, maybe?
No, he didn't. Well, he did mention a statue of an American who fought in World War One that died in World War One before the U.S. got into the war. He joined the French Foreign Legion. They have a statue dedicated to him in Paris. You mentioned a little earlier some of the cringeworthy moments between President Trump and Emmanuel Macron. They were demonstrably friendly to each other. Let's just say that on a number of occasions. And Mr. Macron kind of referenced that in the speech. And then he had a very moving. He brought a guest. I'm going to play you a clip. He brought a guest to the joint session. His speech, like the president will do, and he referred to this guest who is a World War II veteran, a D-Day veteran. So I wanted to play you a little clip from Emmanuel Macron, his joint session to Congress about an hour ago.
It's 1778. The French philosopher Voltaire and Benjamin Franklin met in Paris. John Adams tells the story that after they had shaken hands, they embraced each other by hugging one another in their arms and kissing each other's cheeks. It can remind you something. We are very honored by the presence today of Robert Jackson Ewald, a World War II veteran. Robert Jackson Ewald took part in the D-Day landing. He fought for our freedom 74 years ago. Sir, on behalf of France, thank you. I bow to your courage and your devotion.
I thought that was a particularly nice moment in that speech.
Absolutely. That's today, this
that
morning?
That was just okay. This morning, yeah.
Yeah, so he was thanking a World War II vet who helped to liberate France.
Right, who stormed the beaches at Normandy. Have you ever been to the beaches at Normandy?
My parents have. I have not. Have you?
I have. I went about 4 or 5 years ago, and what I was amazed at was how broad and how long these beaches are. Hundreds of yards from where the surf is pounding to where the soldiers would have had to find a refuge underneath the cliffs.
Let me see. I did see Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
And that opening scene, if you've seen that movie, you'll never forget that opening scene, which is, I guess, about as realistic as you could.
That's what I hear.
You could make a war movie, and I think it was filmed there.
It was.
And I've read a lot about those places, but I've never been. But those brave Americans, Canadians, and Ray, were there other countries?
British.
It was the British, the Canadians, and the Americans, right?
That made up the
D-Day
majority,
invasion.
But there were also some from the some French fighters who had left France and gone to Great Britain, and Polish fighters also.
But
so maybe six different nations,
and maybe some Australians. I don't know, but
right, Australians, sure.
But I do know the Americans, the Canadians, and the Brits were basically each in charge of taking
a section of the beach.
Yeah. Well, you had Omaha Beach. What were the other?
You had Omaha. You had Utah. You had Gold, Juno, and Sword.
Boom! Okay. You got all five.
How about that?
Well, yeah.
Off the top of my head
was,
too.
It's looking like there was several countries, maybe 10 or 12. I know, I'm sure.
They contributed soldiers?
Yeah, I'm sure the U.S. and Canada.
That was like the main.
UK, they made up the most, but it looks like Poland, Norway, New Zealand, Netherlands.
Just like Ray was saying.
Yeah, many others.
But of course, you had the paratroopers that were dropped behind enemy lines. And that whole, I've seen documentaries on that. Many of our listeners had that whole story of the invasion there. The reason we're talking about that today is because the French president is in Washington, D.C. He's speaking for a joint session of Congress. And Steve played a clip from the president of France thanking a World War II vet who was at Normandy Beach. And he was thanking him for helping liberate France. In essence, he was thanking America for helping liberate France during World War II. But anyway, that's fascinating. We don't have time to go into the but that's fascinating that day. And I read about the day that Dwight Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, spent Three gentlemen that I can think of that probably had the most weight on their shoulders of anybody in the 20th century. I'm sure this is open to criticism, but certainly those, General Eisenhower, Winston Churchill, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, what they had to consider, and I'm sure the Prime Minister of Canada too, whose name I don't know at the time, what those fellows had to consider and look at and contemplate was something nobody should ever have to. And that is, they knew, Ray, that they were sending thousands of men to their death for certain.
Even if it was successful, even if everything went according to plan, thousands would die.
Thousands of brothers and sons and fathers. And, you know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, and there's that climactic moment, and we've seen it in, you know, in the different World War II movies where they were waiting for a break in the weather, right, because it was terrible across the channel, and the meteorologist comes in and says there's going to be about a 48-hour window if you want to, and then it's going to get bad again. And Eisenhower goes around the room, should we go, should we go, should we? Some say yes, some say no, but the final decision was his. And he's the one who had to say yes or no, and he said yes. And the full weight, the everything was hanging on his decision. And, you know, he even wrote a note in case the invasion failed, in which he said that the blame should only attach to him for making the decision. And he threw that note away when the invasion was successful, and somebody grabbed it out of the wastebasket later, and you can read it. You know, it's one of the, he was a great leader. He only had to make one decision that day, but it was the right one, and it led to victory in World War II.
Without that invasion, Germany would have maintained control of at least that part of Europe. For
the Allies were already marching up the spine of Italy. They had invaded Sicily earlier, and by the time D-Day came around, they were somewhere around Rome, I believe, and facing a couple defensive lines. Russia was in the process of routing the German army in the east. So it's not – you can't say with certainty that something would have happened, but it was
a delay. It would have delayed.
Was definitely it was the other arm of the pincer movement, the Allies coming in from the west through Normandy.
Hey, where do you go? You said you went there. Did you go there specifically to go to?
We were visiting Paris, and I took a trip. There's a tour that you can sign up for tours. And
how far?
It's about a 3-hour train ride.
From Paris to Normandy.
And so you sign up for the trip, and the one I signed up for included the tickets on the train. It included the van and the tour guide from the D-Day Museum in Normandy. And we went to Point du Oc, which is at the western end of that, where German pillbox or embankment battery is. And then you can drive down through various beaches to get to Sword and Utah and Omaha, where the Americans landed. And that was on the day that I was there. I saw how incredibly
daunting
it must have been to do that. It just,
so how is it? Is it pretty straight up?
It's flat, but it's flat and long.
I'm talking about the cliffs.
You can climb them.
Okay, but it's rugged.
It is.
But you're being shot at.
Right.
It's Right. Absolutely.
Right. Anyway, I'll tell you what, a book has this about this story, not exclusively, and it's written by a liberal, but still, The Greatest Generation by Tom Brokaw.
Right.
I read that 15 years ago, I guess it was, and that is one of my favorite books, because he does a great job in there of describing the patriotism of the day, the love of country, the commitment of those people of that era, those Americans in particular of that era.
I don't know if it's William Ambrose. Ambrose is the other guy that writes.
Yes, Stephen.
Stephen Ambrose.
Stephen
thank
Ambrose,
you.
Right.
What you mean he writes on World War II?
He writes on World War II. Yeah. It's his book, Band of Brothers, I believe, is based on his accounting of the 101st Airborne.
You're listening to the radio program Today's Issues on the American Family Radio Network. Hey, you want to watch our show on your computer, you can go to Facebook and type in Today's Issues, and you can Walker's posting the stories that we talk about here, and you can comment and engage with other listeners, other viewers. We have a YouTube page as well. So go to YouTube, type in Today's Issues live stream, and you can watch the show there. And you want to send us an email, just send it to comments@afr.net. comments@afr.net. I'm Tim with Walker and Steve Jordahl. Steve, what's next in the news?
Well, you mentioned the Trump appointee Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. The travel restriction case hit the Supreme Court today. There was arguments there, and from all the sources that I have and from the Associated Press, it looks like good news for President Trump. I was reading from the Associated Press, President Donald Trump appears likely to win what they call the travel ban case at the Supreme Court. Chief Justice John Roberts and Anthony Kennedy both signaled support for the travel policy in arguments Wednesday at the High Court. The ban challengers almost certainly need one of those two justices to strike down the ban on travelers from several mostly Muslim countries. So good news for
what's scary is that any of the Supreme Court justices would oppose this because this is straight out of the Constitution and straight in, and it's a statute as well that gives the commander-in-chief, the President of the United States, sole authority over, he can, for I don't know how long a period of time, he can.
So as long as he chooses.
That's what it is. It's what it says, right?
Says,
what and for whatever reason he chooses.
That's what it says.
So even if he wanted to say, although he'd never say this, and this is not true, I'm banning people 5'6" and under from coming to America because I dang well feel like it. Okay,
he can do that.
Legally, he could do that, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I hope that this Supreme Court ruling is 9-0, 9-0
right.
in favor
should
of
be.
President Trump.
It
because
should be.
It should be.
Should be.
And I hope that this, because this will be a huge blow to all the lower court judges who have ruled to the contrary.
Yes.
But hopefully this will settle this argument. But, should never have made it through the court system.
When is that, today?
It was today. So
when will they announce their...
That might not happen until June.
Okay.
June or at the end of the session. And it comes on the heels of a decision, I believe it was yesterday, a judge in the Washington, D.C. Court of Appeals, I believe it was. His name is... I don't have the name. Judge William Alsup.
Okay.
It was Bates. Judge Bates ruled that the DACA program has to be continued, and the challenge has to be set aside. President Trump said we're going to end the DACA program, and that's the deferred action on childhood arrivals. That's these kids who arrived.
Well, which was an executive order.
It was an executive order from President Obama, but this judge. John Bates in Washington ruled that President Trump's decision to rescind DACA was unlawful and must be set aside.
Okay, here we go again, folks. Yet another example of a federal judge who again, these people are little gods. They're lifetime appointments, which I think is a big mistake on the part of our founders. But that's...
Well,
I know, but at the time they had a life expectancy of what, 45? Now these people stay till they're 117, on the federal bench, and you can't get rid of them. And I just think that there needs to be some kind of judicial review of federal judges after 20 years or something. Mm-hmm.
Kind of check and balance.
Well, people would say, you do have a check and balance, you can impeach them, but federal judges are never impeached. The only one I can remember was that judge named Nixon. That was caught found to be taking money, bribery.
Yeah.
Bribery. But anyway, that's I'm just saying that you're going to disagree with my criticism.
I'm not saying our founding fathers were perfect, but I think if the founding fathers were to go back now and look over it, they might agree with you that we need some kind of other check and balance. But I think at the time,
besides death,
well, at the time, they probably didn't think that we would have judges who flat out ignore the Constitution. Does that make sense? At
yes.
the time, they had judges.
They wouldn't consider that.
Who revered the Constitution.
Yeah.
It was a universal thing to revere the Constitution and interpret it that way.
The reason that they are loath to put a term limit or any other kind of thing is because it's important that the judiciary be independent of politics.
Oh, and are they ever?
Right. Well,
they're independent of the Constitution.
Yeah.
Huh? No, I understand the reasoning.
Yeah.
I do. I agree with the reasoning of the founders on this in terms of what you just said. They wanted federal judges, Ray, to be above politics or the heat of the moment or money, those kinds of things, so that they could make decisions that were constitutional and in the best interest of the country, without being influenced by the politics of the day, right?
And it's a nice theory, and I think Walker's point is exactly right. In the beginning, they assumed that if you ascended to the federal judgeship, that you would certainly, you used a great word, Walker, revere the Constitution, mm-hmm. because that's what they were fighting for. But now 200 years later, the federal judiciary, it's as partisan as any other
yes.
part of mm-hmm. the U.S. government. Tim, and I think that goes to your point, mm-hmm. that there are Democrat judges and there are Republican judges, and people know that they're, the idea of the quote independent judiciary seems today more like a nice theory than actual reality.
The conservative versus liberal judges are Republican Democrats, the federal judges we're talking about. The Republicans, and I'm trying to be fair about this, the Republicans typically give you a constitutional reason for their decision. And it's logical. You may disagree with it, but there's a constitutional or lawful basis. And let me get one thing, and then you come in on this, Steve. The Democrats or the liberals, they say, I decide this because this is what's morally right in my mind. So I'm going to impose what I feel good about, regardless of what the statute says or regardless of what the Constitution says, because I'm a do-gooder. Go ahead, Steve.
This is a vast oversimplification of the issue, but what justices like Alito and the one who passed away,
Scalia.
Had in there was a static Constitution, what the founders envisioned. In other words, if the Constitution said this in 1776, it's the principles
unless
by which
it's been amended.
Unless it's been amended, it's the principles by which we have to abide now. The other side of this is a living Constitution, where Democrats and all these other people will say, well, you know what, so much time has passed since then, things have changed, therefore we have to change along, and like that lawmaker from California you played earlier, we have to evolve with the times.
Right, and according to them.
According to them, you know, whatever. So now that we all understand, I put in quotes, that gay marriage is fine, we have to reflect that in the law, even though the Constitution doesn't say a thing about it. So
right.
That's the two sides of the thing.
Thank you, Steve, for your contributions to the program the last half hour. Ray, appreciate you being on with us today.
Thanks, Tim.
Walker?
Yes, sir. Glad to
be here. And I apologize for saying D-A-N-G. Earlier, if there were children listening, I should not have said that on the program today, and I apologize for it. We'll see you next time, folks. Have a great day.